Well, if you have your Bible and would care to turn to the prophecy of Habakkuk, we'll be working there this afternoon then. And we've tried to select prophets that we would plunge or dive down into that will give different aspects of reference to Jesus, the servant of the Lord in the Isaiah prophecies, and then a couple dealing with the kingship, the king, coming king in Micah. And then you turn to Habakkuk and you don't have anything that directly points to Christ. Now in the third chapter and the 13th verse, you have part of Habakkuk's prayer where he says to God, "You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed," which I take is the anointed king of Judah. And there you would have the Davidic king, and you may be able to go somewhere from that. But on the whole, you don't have, strictly speaking, messianic prophecies dealing with the Messiah in Habakkuk. So, and by the way, I don't know how you pronounce books over here. You notice I don't say Isaiah. I love that, the way, I don't know, do you say that here, Isaiah, or do you say Isaiah? And you know, the UK people say Isaiah, and I think that has so much class to it. But we Americans just kind of level everything. And so I'm just used to Isaiah, and whether it should be Habakkuk or whatever, or Habakkuk or Habakkuk and so on, sometimes I don't know how I say it, but I'll find out here. But we're looking at that today, but there is in Habakkuk what we might call Jesus doctrine, and you're familiar with a major section of it because even if you've never read Habakkuk, you've read probably Romans and Galatians and Hebrews, and in Romans 1 and Galatians 3 and Hebrews 10, rather, you run into that statement, "But the righteous will live by faith." And this book of Habakkuk is where it comes from. So I thought we would look at it, and especially get behind Romans and Galatians and Hebrews and see the original context from which that statement came. Might help us when we then go into the New Testament. So we'll look at Habakkuk 2:2-5 to begin with. The faith the righteous live by. We'll just work our way through this, I think. But we need a little orientation to Habakkuk. I don't have any stark, raving, novel way of dealing with Habakkuk except that you realize that you've got chapter 1, verses 1-4, where the prophet Habakkuk, now we're over 100 years later than Isaiah and Micah. We're at about, depends when you want to place it, you'll see anywhere from 625 to 600 B.C. In there. But we're in the 7th century B.C. We're still in the southern kingdom of Judah. And there is violence and so on in society in Judah, injustice and violence. And Habakkuk complains about it in chapter 1, verses 1-4. An answer comes to him from Yahweh in chapter 1, verses 5-11. And Yahweh essentially says, well, it's not like I'm doing nothing. I am doing something. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Depending on how you take that, I tend to take that of the Babylonians that the Lord is going to bring as judgment on his own people, Judah. And he says to Habakkuk, I am going to deal with that violence in Judah. I'm going to bring a foreign invader who is going to decimate the kingdom. Then you go back to Habakkuk in chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 1, where Habakkuk says, I'm paraphrasing and summarizing and so on. Well, how can you do that? That doesn't seem quite. Admittedly, the people of Judah are violent and unjust, and all sorts of things are going on there. But how can you use someone who is like the pagan Babylonians to judge and so on? someone who's more righteous than they are. Granted, Judah is not exactly pleasing to you and so on, but boy, those Babylonians are pagans. How can you do that if you're consistent and so on? And then chapter 2, verses 2 through 20, Habakkuk receives God's answer to that and so on. And our text comes in that segment. So this is Yahweh's second answer to Habakkuk. The first answer of the Lord was in chapter 1, verses 5 to 11. And now this is in answer to his new query. Chapter 1, verse 13. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You know, are the Babylonians just going to go on trampling over nations and so on forever and so on? And so here is the answer, chapter 2, verses 2 to 20. Now, you can gauge the importance of this passage. I'm just looking at mainly at 2 to 5. But the whole section would be chapter 2, verses 2 to 20. You can gauge the importance of this in that it is specified that it needs to be written down, verse 2. So Habakkuk was both to proclaim this and yet to leave it on record so its fulfillment could be checked. So really, when he talks about in chapter 2, verse 2, write the vision, record it carefully upon tablets and so on, the vision is really all of verses 2 through 20, in my view. But verses 4 and 5 are a sort of a preface to the vision, a sort of a digest of the vision, a sort of the keynote of the vision. So I don't have any problem focusing on those as long as we realize that verses 2 to 20 contain the whole vision. Now, these verses, I'm thinking of Habakkuk 2, 4, and 5 particularly, these verses especially answer the question how the believers in Judah are to face the onslaught of Babylon when Babylon invades, when Babylon decimates Judah. And they also answer Habakkuk's concern about whether Babylon will go on obliterating nations nonstop. What's going to happen to Babylon? Now, you may not care about that much sitting in a seat in Singapore, whether what happens to Babylon on a sleepy afternoon, but Habakkuk would have. So I want to look at especially Habakkuk 2:4b. But the righteous will go on living by his faith. And let's put that statement into its context and develop it here. Now notice that Habakkuk, first of all, underscores the anchor of faith. The anchor of faith, the last of verse 2 and verse 3. We have to go back up there. He says, write the vision, record it carefully upon tablets so that one who reads it may run. For still the vision is for the appointed time. It pants toward fulfillment. Well, the difference in translation probably in that line. And it will not lie. If it lingers, wait for it. For it will surely come. It will not be late. Now, when he says, then, in verse 4, the righteous will go on living by his faith, what is this faith based on? What is it that anchors faith? And verse 2b through 3 indicates what it is. It is the vision. The vision is used in the sense of revelation, a message, a word that is to be written down. That's what the vision is. What's the vision? It's essentially all that you have in verses 2 to 20, and the summary is this. The vision is that the day is coming when the Babylonian conqueror will be overthrown, and the day is coming when God's kingdom will come on earth, verse 14. Okay? So that's the day's coming when the Babylonian conqueror will be overthrown, and the day's coming when God's kingdom will come on earth, verse 14. faith then goes on living and believing what God has said, that's a vision, what God has said about the future, about the end of Babylon, for instance. Now, this is why I keep in verse 4 the translation faith. The righteous will go on living by his faith. Some of your translations may have live by his faithfulness. And you'll have different discussions and commentaries about the word for faith can really be either faith or it can be faithfulness and so on. And some seem to prefer faithfulness. But the reason I keep the rendering faith in verse 4 is because the object of belief here is this vision. It's God's Word. And that's more an act of faith than is faithfulness. So I keep the traditional translation of faith. This is the same teaching as, some of you are more familiar with the Confession, I think, of 1689. I'm familiar with the Westminster Confession. And the Westminster Confession says about saving faith, by this faith, a Christian believes to be true whatsoever is revealed in the Word for the authority of God Himself speaking therein. Habakkuk would agree with that. You go on believing what God has said in spite of external data to the contrary. But God has said Babylon will be taken care of and His kingdom is going to come. That is the anchor of faith. The object of faith is God's revealed Word. Now, sometimes that's easier said than done. You know that. I ran onto a clip about Finlay Cook. Finlay Cook was a pastor in Scotland, probably, I'm guessing, about 1820 in the Scottish Highlands. And his wife had died. And, well, that's always hard, but he was particularly close. They seemed to have a relationship that just gelled. And she was such a help to him in his ministry and so on. And then she died. And she still lay dead in the house, apparently. It had not been buried yet. And time came for a meal. And there was Finlay Cook at the meal table. And he was asking the blessing on the food. And here's part of what he said as he asked the blessing on the food. Though an angel should come from heaven to tell me that this would work for my good, I should not believe him. But because thou sayest it thyself in thy word, I believe it from thine own mouth. At thy command we went together. At thy command we arted. At thy command we shall be together forevermore. But you see where an angel could have told me that this would work for my good. I wouldn't believe them. But because thou sayest it thyself in thy word, I believe it from thine own mouth. There is by this faith a Christian believes to be true whatsoever is revealed in the word. That is the object, the anchor of faith. Now, you say, okay, a big deal in a way, but that's not all cut and dried, is it? Because that's a daily decision you have to make. It's not just with Babylonians and Judah and Habakkuk. It comes right up to you because you have the same problem. In the face of fear of rejection, you have to go on believing John 6:37. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me, I will never cast out. And some of you probably have grievous problems with assurance. Some of you, at least, probably have the sense that you don't know whether you'll be accepted at the last, and you fear that you won't. Then you say, oh no, we have a firm doctrine of assurance. Christians are different places on that. And there are genuine Christians who nevertheless have real, real difficulties with assurance. And so what do you do if that's the case? You go on believing Jesus' word that the one who comes to Him, He will never cast out, no matter what your feelings may be. You have to hold to that. That's a daily decision, isn't it? Or you have a terrible go-round with your spouse and you don't feel like resolving the conflict. You just want to go on being miffed. But because you believe Ephesians 4, verses 26 and 27, you make an effort to talk it through and get it settled. Faith is not a neat feeling you have. It is confidence in what God has said. That's the anchor of faith. That's in the context here. Now, let's look at the loneliness of faith in the first part of verse 4, where it says, "See, he is swollen with pride. His soul is not upright in him, but the righteous will go on living." What do we have here? Well, there's a contrast here, for one thing, isn't there? Do you see that last line, "but the righteous will go on living"? The contrasting the response that the righteous makes. Well, if he's different, what is the who is the righteous different from? Well, the man in the first part of verse 4. The one who's swollen with pride and his soul is not upright in him. Who is that? That's the Babylonian man of arrogance and pride. You might say he's the macho man. You notice in verse 5, it describes this Babylonian. "Indeed, wine betrays. He's an arrogant man and never rests. He has made his greed as wide as Sheol. He's like death. He never has enough. So he gathers to himself all the nations and collects all the peoples as his own." But he's an arrogant man. That's the phrase in verse 5. You can almost translate something we call macho man. That's the Babylonian who's driven by covetousness and possessions. Last of verse 5. The Babylonian is the one who is the apex of self-sufficiency. And it's the Babylonian, and that's who's being described in the rest of chapter 2, who lives by his power, who lives by his creature comforts, who lives by his possessions, by his dominance, and by his arrogance, and by his control of the world. And in contrast to him, there's the righteous who goes on living by his faith. So I hope you see the contrast here. That little word "but" in the last of verse 4, "but the righteous," is contrasting to the Babylonian pagan in the first part of verse 4. Now, you notice, by the way, how in verses 4 and 5, how how almost the whole, all of verses 4 and 5, almost swallows up this righteous man in the last of verse 4. That's the only reference you have to the righteous in verses 4 and 5. Everything else in verse 4 and in verse 5 describes the arrogant Babylonian. So it's as if he almost gets swallowed up in the whole process. But there's a certain loneliness of faith, isn't there? He stands over against. He takes his own position. "But the righteous will go on living by his faith." And so he's different. He stands. He is called to live in a counter way. Now, it seems to me that when we're preaching this and so on, it's a very natural thing to say things haven't changed. You still live in there's a loneliness about faith. You're often isolated. You're living in opposition and in contrast to others, as here. In the early church, the Christians in the catacombs and so on, the quarters of the imperial page boys. This would be about, I think, maybe the 3rd century A.D., but there was apparently a Christian among these imperial page boys, and he was mocked. By the way, there was a cartoon sketched out on the wall of their quarters. It showed the body of a man hanging on a cross with an ass's head. And there was a kind of byline, slogan underneath. It said, Alexamenos worships his god. And it showed where you had this human body with the ass's head on the cross. Then off to the side, it showed a little stick figure of a lad with his hand raised in a posture of worship. You know what the import of that was. It was, here's this Christian we know, and he worships his crucified Savior. But you see what they meant by that. Anyone like Alexamenos, quite frankly, worships Jesus, is really worships an ass, and he's an ass to worship him. That's what they were saying. That's the kind of mockery. But then someone else has added a little response down at the bottom of this cartoon. And it read, Alexamenos is faithful. Maybe it came from his own hand. But there's always a loneliness of faith. And I don't care if you're in the States. I don't care if you're in Singapore or Malaysia or wherever there is it. Faith is always puts you in opposition. There's a loneliness about it. It's always but the righteous. It's always over against. It's always a loneliness there. So it's the loneliness of faith. You see that here. Now let's get into this line of verse 4 itself. Notice thirdly the doggedness of faith. But the righteous will go on living by his faith. I think that's important, that translation. Usually it says the righteous will live by his faith, and that's okay. But it does not mean the righteous comes to life. The Hebrew verb there is a verb that has the idea of a continual thing. And so I translate it, the righteous will go on living by his faith. Will go on living by his faith as he faces the Babylonians coming and so on. And everything that may be causing terror in our present situation in Judah, Habakkuk says. Now, and so I think that's important. There's a doggedness. He keeps on going. He will go on living. Now, what does that mean? The righteous will go on living by his faith. Now, some of you may be skeptical here. That's okay. But let's ask the question, can this mean to live in or into eternity? Does he mean will go on living by his faith eternally? Is that what it can mean? If they ask that question. And many would object to it. There would be especially some wrinkled-browed scholars who would say, well, we need to avoid reading New Testament doctrines back into Old Testament texts. And I would agree with that, of course. You don't want to read New Testament freight necessarily back into the Old Testament. But you have to ask, when Habakkuk says the righteous will go on living by his faith, it seems that he means more than, quote, he will make it for a few years. Is that all he's saying? I don't think so. This statement, remember, he will go on living by his faith. This statement stands in contrast to the Babylonian who will perish and meet his doom and come under God's judgment. Verses 6 to 20. Now, I could say more on that, but for time's sake, I'm going to not develop that more here. It may not be the primary stress of this text to say that it means live eternally, but I think that's included. That's just my own view there. I think that is included. But let me get back to a little firmer ground here. It also means to go on living by faith in and through troubles. Okay. And especially in this context. So clearly, from verse 3, there's no immediate solution. You see in verse 3 talks about division and so on, and it says if it lingers, wait for it, it will surely come, it will not be late. But it waits for the appointed time, first line of verse 3. So this is not coming immediately. You're not going to get the Babylonians wiped off the map of history right away. They're going to be around a while, etc., etc. So there's no immediate solution. So what do you do? Well, you practice the doggedness of faith. The righteous will go on living by his faith. And what's that mean? It means to go on living by faith. That's faith that suffers through earthly distress. The vision of Babylon's downfall is not yet, as sometimes we use the term. The righteous in Judah will be among those who experience Babylon's bondage and overlordship. Chapter 1, verse 13. Some of Habakkuk and his contemporaries will experience this. Doesn't this tell us something important about biblical faith? It says that faith is not how you spell relief. Faith is how you head into trouble. Faith is not optimism. It is not escape. It is not relief. Some think that faith is equivalent to a bright outlook. It is not necessarily. But the righteous will go on living through sorrow, through cancer, through unemployment, through loneliness, through marital tension, through rejection, through surgery, by his or her faith. That's the sheer doggedness of faith, that continual tense. He will go on living by his faith. Whether Babylonians or something else. Okay. So I hope you see that doggedness of that. I'm not sure that comes out as thoroughly in our New Testament citations and context as it does in Habakkuk's. Now, let's look at the opportunity of faith in verses 4 and 5. You may look at this and you might say, well, Habakkuk 2 is such a maze. The picture is too complicated. The passage is too hard to get a handle on, since it involves nations and international affairs and dates and history. And you never did like history, even though you live in it every day and all that sort of thing. But at verse 4 and 5, does not Yahweh simplify things? If you look at verses 4 and 5 again, doesn't he simplify things? Notice he reduces the whole problem from nations and history down to two individuals. He reduces the whole universe to two men. Now, you might compare Paul's argument in Romans 5, 12 to 21, where Paul reduces everything, doesn't he, to Adam and Christ. Now, he's saying that Habakkuk, or the Lord here in Habakkuk 2, does that. Notice the singulars there in verse 4 and 5. The righteous. And the contrasting singular in verse 5, the arrogant man who never rests, and so on. You have the righteous, the tzaddik, and you have the gever, the macho man, the arrogant man of verse 5. The righteous in verse 4 stands against the restless in verse 5. You notice how the Babylonian is described in verse 5. He's an arrogant man and never rests, and so on. Now, who is this righteous? Think about what it is to be righteous. To be righteous does not mean to be self-righteous. I don't know if here that's a common misreading or not. I think that's an easy thing in American setting, that if someone is thought to be righteous, goody two-shoes. sort of a self-righteous idea. That's not what it's talking about when it says righteous. Think of the Old Testament context. Think of Psalm 32, where the righteous is referred to in verse 11 of Psalm 32. What's that mean? In the context of the psalm, it means he is the one forgiven and acquitted of guilt, verses 1 to 5. Okay? He's the one who trusts in Yahweh, Psalm 32, verse 10. Or, just go a couple psalms over, Psalm 34, verse 19. The righteous, verse 19, are those who take refuge in Yahweh and are never condemned, verse 22. Psalm 34, verses 19 and 22. So these are people who place themselves under Yahweh's protection. They are not... The point is not that there's some self-righteousness. Now, if Yahweh reduces the whole universe to two men, and you have the righteous who goes on living by faith, and you have the arrogant Babylonian that's going to live by his covetousness and his rolling over the world and all of that sort of thing, is it really that complicated? You have two specimens before you. You can go on being restless and never settled and never content and never having enough. Or you have an opportunity whether you will live by faith or whether you'll go on being a Chaldean or not. Which will be your people, you might say. Now, that's Habakkuk 2. 2 to 5, trying to develop and give us at least an appreciation, hopefully, of that unpacking the righteous will live by faith. Now, let's do, in a time remaining, let's do the last passage of the text of Habakkuk, which is Habakkuk 3, 16 to 19. The times the righteous face. And with the proviso that we understand again that this is part of a larger chunk of material. This is part of Habakkuk's prayer. You see that in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1, at the very first part. So the whole, and then you notice that at the end it has a subscript to the choir master with stringed instruments and so on. So all of chapter 3 of Habakkuk is the prophet's prayer. Just to give you a basic, it's very difficult to translate chapter 3 of Habakkuk, especially verses 1 to 15. Excuse me, and if you compare English versions, you'll say, wow, there's a good bit of difference sometimes there. But if you notice, the majority of Habakkuk's prayer is concentrated on God from verses 3 to 15. And let me just give you a sketch of, this won't answer the details, but in verses 3 through 7, you have a picture of what happens when God comes. Verses 3 to 7, what happens when God comes. And you'll notice that's in the third person. Talks about Yahweh as he and him. Third person description. Then verses 8 through 15 is the second part that speaks of why it is God comes. Why it is God comes. And that's in the second person. You, second person address. Why is it that God comes? He comes to save his people. So what happens when God comes? Boy, think of the fireworks really start, verses 3 to 7. And then why it is God comes, 8 to 15, to bring salvation and deliverance to his people. Now, it's in that context, then, that we look at the very last part of Habakkuk 3, verses 16 to 19. Let's read through that text now. Habakkuk says, I heard and my insides tremble. At the voice, my lips quiver. Rottenness enters into my bones and my legs tremble beneath me, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree does not blossom, and though there's no fruit on the vines, though the produce of the olive tree has failed, and the fields have not produced food, though he has cut off the flock from the fold, and though there are no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in Yahweh. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. Yahweh, my Lord, is my strength, and he has made my feet like those of a deer, and he makes me tread upon my high places. To the music master of my stringed instruments. Now, we need to understand what the prophet is doing in our text. And you notice he's had the revelation of the vision in chapter 2, and especially that point in chapter 2, verse 4, but the righteous will go on living by his faith. So what's he doing in chapter 3, verses 16 to 19? He's applying Habakkuk 2:4b to his own situation. The prophet is applying that word to his own case. What's it going to mean for Habakkuk to go on living by faith when the Babylonians rip apart the land? And so this is his response. And he goes on trembling and trusting at the same time. Now, pondering his confession of faith here, verses 16 to 19, should encourage us to go on living by faith as well. Let's see how he applies it. What's he say to us about this whole matter of biblical faith? Well, verse 16, he speaks to us of the turmoil faith can know. Now, the principle here is, looking at verse 16, the principle is one can be in severe turmoil and yet still have vital faith. Indeed, that very turmoil may be evidence of faith. Let me try to get at that. What is it that Habakkuk hears? He said, I heard and my insides tremble. Well, he's really referring back probably to what he knows is going to come from chapter 1, verse 5. And the Lord is raising up the, doing a work, and he's raising up the Chaldeans, chapter 1, verse 6, and all that's going to evolve for his people. So it's really the word of the Babylonian invader, the prospect of a foreign invasion and the horrors of that for both prophet and people. It tears him up. Notice the fourfold description there in verse 16. My insides tremble, my lips quivered, rottenness enters my bones, and my legs tremble beneath me. That's pretty emphatic. So, there's the task that he dreads. What must he do then? I must wait quietly. Last of verse 16. That is, there's nothing he can do to change the threat of what is coming. One can only brace to endure it and wait for Yahweh to deal with the desolator. So I must wait quietly. A little bit of difference on how to translate the next two lines. I think the better translation is, I must wait quietly for the day of distress to come upon people who invade us. I have to wait for the Lord to deal in judgment on these invaders in His own time. Now, you must see, though, that your turmoil or Habakkuk's turmoil is not a denial of faith, but the evidence of faith. He's all upset, verse 16, precisely because he believes Yahweh's word. Hope you can see that. It's the truth that gives him trouble. Because you're upset and trembling does not mean you lack faith. Would you say Jesus lacks faith because in John 12:27 he said, now is my soul troubled? Would you say, get a hold of yourself, Lord, start believing? No. So here, Habakkuk heard Yahweh's word. And because he believes Yahweh's word of what is coming, he's disturbed. That's a sign of faith. Strange as it may sound. Now, once our oldest boy was, I don't know what he was, 4 or 5. He was at some preschool near our home. And for some reason, my wife didn't get down at her normal time to pick him up. I think he was to be picked up at 12:30, right, you know, just quickly after lunch, during the lunch hour. And for some reason, she was delayed. And our oldest son, he was a pretty sharp kid. Perceptive and so on. And he started crying. He was all upset because his mother hadn't come to get him on time. Now, most kids in that preschool couldn't tell time. They didn't know squat about time. Look at the clock on the wall. It didn't mean anything. So they weren't. They wouldn't be. But see, Luke could tell time. He'd learned to tell time early. Sharp kid. Brilliant. But that's precisely why he had problems, because he knew more. Well, that's the thing here. You believe and you tremble. It's precisely because he believes Yahweh's word that he's so upset. Sometimes it makes for problems. I simply want you to see that this turmoil and distress is the turmoil and distress of faith. We sometimes think that faith will relieve the pressure and the stress. You know, if we could just get, what's the hymn, Higher Ground? We just get up there somewhere and be relieved. No, faith may well increase the pressure and the stress. If I believe Jesus' words in Luke 17:22, then I will be more upset, not less. You remember he said the days are coming when you will want to see one of the days of the Son of Man and you will not see it. Things will get so bad. You wish you were in the time when the Son of Man is ruling and so on. And things are stable and all that, but you won't see that. If I really believe that, I may get more upset rather than less. It's necessary to state this because, you see, we tend to think that faith naturally and automatically means a peaceful, placid state of mind. Not necessarily. Now, that's all I'm arguing for there. Okay? Now, all of that is the turmoil faith can know. Verse 16. Now, second, notice the destitution faith may face. Verse 17 and a little bit of 18. Now, what's the principle here? The principle is faith does not guarantee my level of comfort. Faith may have to exist in utterly destitute circumstances. I do not like verse 17. I do not like this doctrine, but faith may have to exist in utterly destitute circumstances. Now look at the picture in the text in verse 17. What you have is a devastated land and economy. I mean, it's an agrarian situation, right? So it's couched that way. You have a worst case scenario. Though the fig tree does not blossom, though there's no fruit on the vines, though the produce of the olive tree has failed and the fields have not produced food, though he has cut off the flock from the fold, and though there are no cattle in the stalls. What sort of life do you have if you're in Judah without figs and grapes and olive oil and grain and wool and milk? Every luxury and necessity he sees as taken away. This is evidence probably of God's judgment, all of the covenant curses in Deuteronomy 28. Well, that's part of what will be involved for the nation. And it's also what happens when a land is ravaged by an invading army that might have a scorched earth policy. And he may be envisioning that. And you see, the remnant, and this is the thing, Habakkuk and those like him that go on living by faith through this, the believing remnant will experience this too. There is no exemption card given to the remnant believers. They don't flash something to the Babylonians and say, sorry, we're not involved in this. No. No, they're not spared the havoc and the horrors of the invasion. Now, if he was writing to perhaps an industrialized nation today, perhaps Habakkuk would have couched verse 17 a bit differently. He might have said all industry grinds to a halt, stock market crashes, the underground trains are always on strike, the utilities no longer function, terrorists leave neighborhoods in flames, grocery shelves are bare, agriculture is in ruins, etc. But still, you see, it's the same, you get the picture. So God, in His mercy, may repeatedly cushion us from this. And I think it's only right to pray that He might. But sometimes He may call faith to suffer what Philippians 3, 7, and 8 calls the loss of all things. Boy, what a phrase. And if He does, if you are stripped of all human resources, verse 17, it does not mean that you lack faith. Now, why do we need to make such a point? Well, because much contemporary faith and prosperity teaching is afloat. And it's not just what we sometimes call the prosperity gospel that we meet in the larger circles of the church. Sometimes it's just flimsy piety and bad theology as well. There's a hymn that probably, I don't know if you sang it, probably, I would assume. It's titled Trust and Obey. I know some don't see it the same way, but there's one stanza there that really bothers me. I'm not against trusting and obeying. I'm not against the, you know, but when it says not a shadow can rise, not a cloud in the skies, but His smile quickly drives it away, not a doubt or a fear, not a sigh nor a tear can abide while we trust and obey. Really? I don't know if Habakkuk could swallow that. I don't sing that stanza. I would be a hypocrite. Please understand, I know there's such a thing as poetic license, but there's also such a thing as bad theology. And we don't just throw rocks sometimes at prosperity theology and so on. Sometimes some of it's in our hymn book. We got to watch it. So you have this situation, the destitution faith may face. You may have everything seemingly stripped from you. And so on. Except a Father who's delighted in you. I thought it was ironic when I look back on it. I was preaching on this text one time on another occasion, Habakkuk 3, 16 to 19. It was on Sunday, November 7th, 1993, so it's been a while back. The day before that, we had a funeral in our congregation. One of our elders had died. He was 55 years old. He had something happened. They didn't expect it, but something went wrong with his pancreas and so on. And one thing went to another. He came on life support. And you were there with the family at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore for times while you gather around the bed and you just watch him hooked up to wires and tubes and so on and all that sort of thing. And they began to say to the wife, look, you probably need to just pull the plug and unhook him. He's probably brain dead, there's no hope. And fortunately, she was saved from having to make that decision because he died. You could, fairly soon after that, he stood around the bed where Dan was and the three sons and his wife, and you watched the digital display go down and down to nothing. And there was a widow and three boys without a dad. Habakkuk 3:17 said, you know, you can go through stuff like that. You can have what seems to be most precious taken from you. And yet you may still go on living by faith. That's the destitution faith may face. Now, notice thirdly here, the joy that faith can confess in verses 18 to 19b. And it's quite exalting. He says, verse 18, yet I will exult in Yahweh. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. Yahweh, my Lord, is my strength, and He made my feet like those of the deer, and He makes me tread upon my high places. So in the midst, and this is the principle here, in the midst of desperate circumstances, faith can not only persist and endure, but actually rejoice. Well, apparently Habakkuk's can. I don't know if mine would or not. Hopefully the Lord would make me able to do that, but it seems like a large order. But in the midst of desperate circumstances, faith can not only persist and endure, but can actually rejoice. Notice the defiance in this joy. Now, emphatic pronoun in verse 18, yet I will exult in Yahweh. Has to be seen in light of all the desolation of verse 17. So this is not mere resignation. This is not mere endurance. This is not stoicism. This is not a sort of a grit and bear it attitude. It is not a this too shall pass sentiment. It is a triumphant joy. I will exult in Yahweh. Now notice the location of this joy. He says he rejoices in Yahweh and in the God of my salvation. He rejoices in the one whom the Babylonians cannot take away from us. You know, when they gave the land out, parcel land out in Joshua 13:33, the Levites didn't get an inheritance of land because they said Yahweh is their inheritance. Well, Habakkuk is sort of perhaps saying, I'm sort of in the Levite situation. The Babylonians may get the land. They may come in and invade and desolate it, but there's part of my inheritance that they can't take away from me. I can still exult in Yahweh and in the God of my salvation. That inheritance they can't take. And then notice the secret of this joy and the power behind it. In verse 19, Yahweh my Lord is my strength. So the joy and the confidence that he has does not come from his own insides. It comes from divine enabling. It's because Yahweh is my strength that I can exalt like this. He makes me able to do it. This is the same thing as you have, I think, unless I'm missing something, in Philippians 4:13, where Paul says, and he's talking, you know, about I've learned to be content in all kinds of circumstances, in circumstances when I have much and when I have little. I've learned the secret, etc. He says, I can go on, or I can do all things in the one who keeps giving me strength. Continual present participle, as I recall. That's the secret. That brings steadfastness and steadiness. And by the way, the image of the deer in the last of verse 19 probably has to do with not so much with fleetness, but with steadiness and with stability. Now, what's he saying here? I think he's saying, you know, there's a secret that the Lord gives in our utterly desolate times, and it is that He keeps us on our feet. There was a fellow by the name, E.B. Pusey. Some of you may have heard of him. Some of you may have read his Minor Prophets commentary at some time back in, I think, the 1800s in England. But Pusey lost his wife to death, and his statement sometime afterwards says, it was as if the rushing waters were up to my chin. But underneath the chin, there is a hand supporting it. There you go. Just about overwhelmed. The water's up there, but underneath the chin, there's a hand supporting it. That's it. And so what you have here, I think, is what Psalm 73:23 says. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. Now, one more thing here, a fourth point that seems anticlimactic, but I think we need to take it into account. The tradition faith should receive. The last of verse 19. The tradition faith should receive. And that's just to the music master on my stringed instruments. What are we to make of these worship notes? This one in 19C. And perhaps you might notice in verse 1, beginning, the prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigion oath. Now, we don't know what Shigion oath was. Perhaps the tune that was proposed for it, for the prayer, when it was used in public worship. And then the who knows what it means, Selah, in verses 3, 9, and 13, which Pastor Way commented on yesterday. Depends who you talk to, what it means. And some just shrug their shoulders. But anyway, you know when you've got that. These are notes that have to do with the use of this piece in public worship. Now, that's important, I think. That is, it will be used again and repeatedly in public worship. What are the assumptions underlying this? The assumptions are that this prayer ought to be used in worship. And secondly, that there will be a need for it. It's as if Habakkuk is saying, we believers who are living in, say, 607 BC, awaiting the devastation that Babylon will wreak on us, are not the only body of the Lord's people who are going to be overwhelmed and feel like we are swept away. There will be others. Let's leave the deposit. Let's leave this prayer. So it's as if they're saying, here is how you pray. You make no secret of your fears, verses 1 and 2. Then you fill your vision with God who comes to save, verses 3 to 15. And then you look again at your circumstances and delight in the joy no one can take from you, verses 16 to 19b. Aren't Habakkuk and company kind? They say, you know, there will be other generations who will be living in the midst of the years. And they will ask, how do we pray in such times? And one answer is, take the prayers of others who have already walked this way and pray them again. Use them in worship. Pray them in unison. If you're so weighed down with trouble and you don't know, how's Paul put it, what to pray for as you ought, then use our words, Habakkuk says. Pray our prayers. God will recognize them. He's heard them before. Well, let's close this session in a word of prayer. Oh Lord, such knowledge is too big and too wonderful for us. That faith would be, in a way, so comforting even in all its hard times and difficulties. And that you should stoop down to make us strong enough to even go on believing. And that you leave behind a deposit of worship and prayers that we can go on and use in crying out to you. You have provided for us, O Lord our God. You are a kind and gracious Lord. and we give you our thanks. Amen.